it should be understood to be a real war. And it's not a new war, it's an old war. Furthermore, it's a perfectly conscious war everywhere, but specifically in the United States, where there happens to be, it's a very free country, but it happens to have a highly class-conscious business class, and always has. And it's very free and open, so you have a lot of information about it. They talk, you have their records. And they have long seen themselves as fighting a bitter class war, except they don't want anybody else to know about it. Occasionally, someone else gets the news. Rather famous cases. Doug Fraser, about 20 years ago, 1978, I think, when he pulled out of the Labor Management Council and condemned business leaders for, words were roughly like this, for having decided to fight a one-sided class war against working people, the poor, the unemployed, minorities, even members of the middle class, and for having torn up the fragile social compact that had been achieved during periods of growth and prosperity. In fact, had been achieved primarily, although he didn't say this, primarily through rather militant struggle, very militant struggle under harsh conditions back in the 1930s. Now, the only thing wrong with his statement is that it was way too late. That war that he's talking about was initiated as soon as the fragile social compact was established back in the 1930s, and very openly. You don't have to go to secret records to find out about it, nor do you have to have been at the wrong end of the clubs when the strikes were broken up in the late 30s to know about it. It was completely public. The reason it's not well known is because neither the educational system nor scholarship, like Harvard and so on, pay any attention to it. It's not a topic that's studied. So there's no doubt that one of the major issues of 20th century history, surely in the United States, is corporate propaganda. That's a huge industry. In fact, it extends over the, obviously, the commercial media, but the whole range of systems that reach the public, the entertainment industry, television, a good bit of what appears in the schools, a lot of what appears straight out in the newspapers and so on, huge amount of that comes straight out of the public relations industry, which was established in this country early in the century and sort of developed mainly in the 20s and on, and has become an enormous industry. It's now spreading over the rest of the world, but it's primarily here. And its goal from the beginning, perfectly openly and consciously, was to control the public mind, as they put it. And the reason was that the public mind was seen as the greatest threat to corporations. That's from early in the century. Business power was strong, but it's a very free country by comparative standards, and it's hard to call on state violence, not impossible, but hard to call upon state violence to crush people's efforts to achieve freedom and rights and justice. So therefore, it was recognized early on that it's going to be necessary to control people's minds. I should say that's not a new insight either. You know, you can read it in David Hume and the Enlightenment, where it was already recognized. In fact, go back to the earliest stirrings of democratic revolutions in England in the 17th century, and there already was concern that we're not going to be able to control people by force, and we therefore have to control them by other means, controlling what they think, what they feel, their attitudes toward one another. I mean, all sorts of mechanisms of control are going to have to be devised, which will replace the efficient use of force and violence that was available to a much greater extent earlier on, and as has been fortunately declining, you know, not uniformly, but often declining through the years, particularly here, leading to the need for other methods of control. You don't have to move very far from the Cambridge elite to learn about it. The leading figure of the public relations industry is a highly regarded Cambridge liberal, you know, Roosevelt Kennedy liberal, died recently, Edward Bernays, who wrote the standard manual of the public relations industry back in the 1920s, which is very much worth reading. Remember, I'm not talking about the right wing here. This is way at the left liberal end of American politics. His book, it's called On Propaganda, or maybe just Propaganda. I should mention that terminology changed during the Second World War. Prior to the Second World War, the term propaganda was used quite openly and freely for controlling the public mind. It got bad connotations during the Second World War because of, you know, Hitler and that sort of thing. So the term was dropped, and now there's other terms used. But if you read the literature in the social sciences and the public relations industry and so on back in the, say, 20s and the 30s, they describe what they're doing as propaganda. This manual is for the rising public relations industry, and he opens by pointing out that the conscious manipulation of the organized habits and opinions of the masses is the central feature of a democratic society. It's the essence of democracy, as he later pointed out. And he said, we have the means to carry this out now. He said, we have the means to regiment people's minds as efficiently as armies regiment their bodies. And we must do this. First of all, it's the essential feature of democracy, but also, sort of footnote, it's the way to maintain power structures and authority structures and wealth and so on, roughly the way it is. It's worth remembering something else that they usually don't teach you very much about in school, and that is, if you go back to the origins of American society, it was founded on the principle that was stated very explicitly by the leading framer, James Madison, at the Constitutional Conventions, as he put it, the primary responsibility of government is to protect the minority of the opulent against the majority. And Madison recognized, he's a smart guy, that this was going to be a serious problem if a democratic system were established. It was going to, if people had the right to vote, he used England as his model. England was the model for democracy in those days, right? It's like, I'm talking about 1780s. And he pointed out in the debates on the Constitutional Convention something which everybody ought to read in third grade in a free society. I mean, this is the origins of our society, you know. He pointed out that in England, if they had the right to vote, which fortunately they didn't, he said pretty soon you would find people calling for redistribution of property and for a tax on property rights, for what nowadays we'd call agrarian reform. It was mostly an agricultural society. He didn't use the term agrarian reform, but same thing. He said people will start calling for agrarian reform. Obviously, that's intolerable. And we have to protect our own society against that kind of injustice by ensuring that the rights of property prevail. He recognized that, he said it's a problem now. He was already concerned in the 1780s by what he called symptoms of a leveling spirit. That is, people are trying to, you know, feel that property ought to be more equitably distributed. That's a danger. But he said that the danger is going to become much more severe over time as more and more people are marginalized and dispossessed and secretly yearn for a more equal distribution of life's blessings. Now, if those people get the vote, we're going to be in trouble, because it's going to be hard to protect the minority, the opulent, against the majority, which is what government's all about. And he therefore designed a constitutional system which was intended to prevent that danger. The way he set it up, he and the other framers, because it was virtually unanimous, I mean, there's virtually no disagreement about this. The one person who might have disagreed, Jefferson, was not part of any of this stuff. The constitutional system as he designed it was supposed to put power in the hands of the wealthy, who are the more capable set of men, I'm quoting. Power must reside in the hands of the wealthy, the more capable set of men, with the general population fragmented, factionalized, dispersed, in conflict, and so on and so forth. Well, this is like, we're now 1780s. Okay, it's been a pretty stable system. And as it's been harder, as the franchise has increased, so over time more and more people did get the right to vote. And that just raised the danger. Furthermore, the power of the state to coerce by violence, and that includes the power of private power, like the power of, say, Carnegie to hire Pinkertons and so on, as that has declined, the need to resort to these other measures of factionalization, instilling hatred, marginalizing people, straight propaganda, and so on, that's increased, and very consciously. So by the time you get to the 1920s, where I started from, it's recognized that huge resources must go into the conscious manipulation of the organized habits and opinions of the masses, and we have to regiment them, their minds, as well as an army regiments their bodies, and we have the methods for it, and those methods are advertising, entertainment, straight propaganda in the media, schools, so on and so forth. The 20s was an important period in this regard. It looks as if labor is under attack now, but remember, in the 20s it had been smashed. The major American historian of labor historian, David Montgomery, has a book which you probably know, or should if you don't, called The Fall of the House of Labor, very, you know, sort of standards, important book on the history of the labor movement. It ends in the 1920s, because that's when the House of Labor had fallen, and with a lot of violence in that case, state violence, Wilson's Red Scare, the leading labor leader was in jail, Eugene Debs, where the New York Times had said years ago he ought to be sent, and so on. It was, there'd been a big strike wave at the end of the First World War, smashed, labor movement destroyed, the whole thing wiped out. As Montgomery points out at the end of his book, labor had been virtually destroyed. Working people had to privatize their lives and aspirations. They sort of work out survival strategies for themselves, not with others, because the modes of cooperation and common struggle had been eliminated. And they did it, he ends up by saying, in a most undemocratic America, which is true. It was a highly undemocratic country, using a combination of modes of violence and coercion and repression and increasingly propaganda to prevent the dangers that Madison was worrying about, you know, almost 200 years earlier, that more and more people would secretly sigh for a better access to life's blessings and might even do something about it if they had a functioning democracy, which therefore couldn't be permitted. I should just comment in fairness to James Madison that these remarks are not quite correct. The reason was that Madison was pre-capitalist. He's like just about everybody, you know, Adam Smith, you know, all the great figures from the Enlightenment. They're mostly pre-capitalist and very anti-capitalist in conception. You know, you can't say they're anti-capitalist because there was no modern industrial capitalism around for them to have an opinion about. And this is a matter of interpretation. You know, it's a matter of how you read text, so you can read them a lot of different ways. But the way I read them, they were very anti-capitalist. That includes Adam Smith. And I think you can demonstrate that. But certainly Madison was. He believed that when he put power in the hands of the wealthy class of men, you know, the more capable set of men, the wealthy of the country, that they were going to be, as he put it, enlightened statesmen and benevolent philosophers who would devote themselves to the welfare of all. Okay, that's a very pre-capitalist conception, you know, that once you give power to the hands of the rich, they're just going to be benevolent philosophers and they're going to devote themselves, you know, every minute of their day to the welfare of everyone else. I mean, it's like what corporate executives tell you, you know, they're sort of understand, you have to say that, but by now, you know, nobody believes it except the people who read these, you know, watch these movies which show you how it works. In those days, Madison really believed it, and he very quickly discovered that it wasn't true. Within a few years, by 1792, he was already very upset about the fate of this democratic experiment, which he thought was failing. He condemned what he called the daring depravity of the times as the business leaders who have now been given power use that power, he said, to become the tools and tyrants of government. They overwhelm government with their powers and combinations, and they're bribed by its largesses. And they're just serving self-interest, you know, not the interest of the general public. And he thought that was deplorable and so on, but that's because he began to, he perceived the way the system that he had designed was actually functioning. That description, you know, rhetoric is kind of nice. Some people don't use fancy rhetoric like that today, but it's a perfect description of today. What's called the industrial capitalist system today is in fact one in which private power is the tool and tyrant of government, overwhelms it by its combinations, it's bribed by its largesses. That's a pretty good description of 1997. With all the changes that have taken place since 1792, there's a good deal of stability to all this, including the commitment to the principle that the primary goal of government is to protect the minority, the opulent, from the majority. You read yesterday's budget proposal carefully and you'll get a good example of how that commitment plays itself out. And the increasingly significant idea, overwhelmingly significant idea, particularly among liberals, you know, like, say, Bernays, that it is necessary to control people's minds because they're too much of a danger. We, as one of the leading, take a look at, say, the Encyclopedia of Social Sciences, in, you know, big encyclopedia in 1933, so this is still pre-Second World War, there's an entry on propaganda. Remember, propaganda was a usable term then. And the entry on propaganda is written by a very distinguished political scientist, liberal political scientist, Harold Lasswell, one of the founders of modern political science, in fact, of communications and so on. And it's worth reading. It's a page or two, you know, Xerox it out and read it. He says, these are paraphrases, but they're pretty close to quotes. He says that we must not succumb to democratic dogmatisms about people being the best judges of their own interests. They are not. You know, we're the best judges of their interests. We smart guys. We must therefore ensure that those idiots out there don't get into trouble, you know, by actually using their theoretical right to vote to interfere where they don't belong, like in the public arena. So we got to keep them out of the public arena somehow and make sure that it's just us smart guys who are in there. And it's for their good, of course. It's kind of like you don't let, you know, your three-year-old, in my case, grandchild, run across the street, you know, because she may want to run across the street, but it's beyond improper to let her have that choice. And the same is true about the masses. They have to be controlled. They have to be controlled at the workplace. They have to be kept out of the political arena. They're not going to understand the need to protect the minority, the opulent, against the majority. They're going to have all these strange leveling impulses, and they're going to do all kinds of things which will, you know, mess the world up in all sorts of horrible ways. So for their benefit, we have to regiment their minds the way an army regiments their bodies, ensure that they're under control, make it very clear that they don't participate in workplace management, and certainly not in the political arena. They're to be outside somewhere. And the dedication with which mm-hmm. this task has been pursued is pretty awesome. Right after the fall of the House of Labor in the 1920s, when American labor really was smashed, and people were privatized and tried to accommodate individually to a most undemocratic America, as Montgomery and others have pointed out. That was a time when there was great awe about the end of history and the utopia of the masters, and it's all over, you know, us good guys have won, everybody else is at our feet, kind of like some of the stuff you read today. And it sort of looked like that, you know, it's pretty much looked that way. Well, a few years later, as you know, the whole thing collapsed. And there was militant working class struggle and all sorts of other popular activism, and there had to be an accommodation. You know, there had to be some kind of accommodation to these unwashed masses who were getting out of line, sit-down strikes and all sorts of things. And there was, indeed. There was this fragile social compact that Doug Fraser referred to was indeed established. It wasn't a gift. You know, it was won by struggle. Meaning the labor laws and the limited social system. In fact, American workers back in the 1930s began to get the rights that had been standard long before, even in much more brutal societies. You read the right-wing British press over the, say, early part of this century, they can't believe how bad American workers are treated. You know, the same was true of visitors from Australia and so on. By the 1930s, the U.S. was sort of brought into the more or less the mainstream of industrial society on these matters, to a limited extent, in fact, but to some extent. And that caused hysteria among the masters. So you read the business press by 1936 or 37. Again, these are things which in a really free society, everybody would study in elementary school, because they're really important. That these give the real framework of the society, in my view. They were talking about the hazard facing industrialists and the rising political power of the masses and how we must do something to save ourselves or our way of life will be gone and we don't have a lot of time to do it. They started right away. By the late 30s, there was a big anti-labor campaign that had built up. With new techniques, you know. There was still use of force, but it was understood that that's not going to work the way it did. So there was a shift to more propaganda, community organizing. The main idea, it was called the Mohawk Valley Formula, I guess, is that what it was called? Something like that. Yeah, Mohawk Valley Formula was designed by a lot of public relations hotshots around 36, 37, at the time of some of the steel strikes, to have a new, what they called scientific methods of strike breaking. We don't just come in, you know, with clubs and shoot people and smash their heads and that sort of thing. We do it the scientific way because the old way doesn't work anymore. And the scientific methods of strike breaking were, in fact, drawn from the public relations ideas of the kind that I talked about. The main idea was to mobilize the community against the strikers and the union activists, to present a picture which is by now so standard that you can hardly turn on the tube without seeing it. Because it's just poured out in like streams ever since then. The basic idea is to present a picture of the world that looks kind of like this. There's us, you know, kind of like big happy family in the community. The honest workman going off every morning with his lunchbox, his loyal wife who's making the meals and taking care of the kids, the hardworking executive who's toiling day and night in the interests of his workers and the community, the friendly banker who's running around looking for people to lend money to, and so on and so forth. That's us, you know, and we're all in harmony. Harmony was a big word. We're in harmony. We're all together. It's Americanism. You might take a look at that word Americanism. It's an unusual term. It's the kind of term that you only find in totalitarian societies, as far as I know. So like in the Soviet Union, anti-Sovietism was considered the gravest of all crimes, you know. And the Brazilian generals had some concept like that, anti-Brazilian. But try, say, publishing a book on anti-Italianism and see what happens in the streets of Rome or Milan. I mean, people won't even bother laughing. It's a ludicrous idea. The idea of Italianism or Norwayism or something like that, or these would just be objects of ridicule in societies that have some kind of residue of a democratic culture inside people's heads. I don't mean in the formal systems. But in totalitarian societies, it is used, and as far as I know, the United States is the only free society that has such a concept. Maybe there's another one. You might try it in places, you know. But anyhow, Americanism is an anti-Americanism and un-Americanism and so on. These are concepts which go along with harmony and getting rid of those outsiders and all that kind of stuff. Another part is simply to induce hatred and fear among people. So it's a diverse society. You go to Europe, most places are pretty uniform. This is a very diverse society. So it's easy for propagandists. It's pretty easy to get people to hate the guy next door because it looks a little different or one thing or another. And huge campaigns go on to instigate divisions among people. I don't have to tell you about this. It's all so familiar. You go on. But these are very natural techniques of social control. And if you can't control people by force, you have to control their minds, you have to control their attitudes, you have to, exactly like they say. Well, going back to the Mohawk Valley formula, the idea was to move into a community, flood it with where there's a strike going on, flood it with propaganda, you know, take over the media, the churches, the schools, everywhere else, pour in this propaganda about harmony and so on, the way I described it. And then there's those bad guys out there who are trying to disrupt our harmonious lives, you know, like that union organizer is probably a communist or an anarchist anyway, and probably un-American, and he's trying to, you know, destroy all these wonderful things we have, and we got to band together and kick him out. You know, we have to defend our way of life against this. A lot of religion gets thrown in. Remember that the United States is an extremely fundamentalist country. I mean, you look comparatively, comparative statistics. It usually religious fundamentalism declines as industrialization goes up. It's pretty close correlation. The United States is off the chart. You know, it ranks with devastated peasant societies, probably more fundamentalist than Iran. Why this is so, is, I don't know. But, I mean, in fact, it's a complicated question. But one factor is that it was certainly consciously fomented by business leaders. That goes way back to the 19th century, when they were supporting their favorite, John D. Rockefeller's favorite evangelist was, who we poured a lot of money into, was some guy who said that people ought to have more enlightened ideas than labor agitation. That was one of his famous phrases. And the more enlightened ideas are, you know, go to church and listen to orders and, you know, do what they tell you and shut up. You know, that's the more enlightened idea. And it's a really interesting case because the Mohawk Valley was the model that was later used for strike breaking and destruction of the labor movement in the post-war period. So it's quite interesting to see what happened right there. Incidentally, I don't know any literature on this. Do you? Yeah, so these are untouchable topics, right. You know. And you can almost say that anything that's important, you know, it's going to matter for people's lives, it's got to be sort of off the agenda. And it sort of makes sense. You don't want people to know about it. Like, you don't want people to know the wrong kind of thing. After all, that makes sense. You know, it's like it's not a conspiracy or anything. It's just common sense if you have a certain degree of power and authority and privilege. You just don't want people to know things that might be harmful to them because they're really like children, remember. And we're the ones who have to make the decisions for them. There's an enormous amount of money and effort goes into this. It's not the only thing by any means. There's a lot of other reasons why the United States is so unusual in this respect, but this is one of them. And it's used. I mean, whether that's the source or not, it's certainly used, you know, always. So another technique of trying to create the marginalization of people, the removing people from the actual social and political struggles that might make their lives better. You know, maybe and to keep them from working with one another by dividing them up in all sorts of ways. And in a myriad techniques, you know, find a fashion to keep the hated masses out of the public arena where they don't belong. And certainly out of anything having to do with control of the economic system where it's unthinkable that they should have a role. That's got to be in the hands of private tyrannies. That's unquestionable. Where the United States has acted internationally, it's the same way. You know, you look at the trail of intervention, it's almost always the same. Not just third world countries, for example. Like, I just came back from Italy, okay? You may not know this, but Italy was the target of the major CIA activities since its origins. The internal record runs dry around the mid-70s, so don't know, can't say after that. But from the origin of the CIA in 1947 up to at least the mid-70s, Italy seems to have been targeted more than any other country in an effort to undermine Italian democracy. Italy was regarded as sort of a semi-third world country, had a very strong labor movement. And when the American army, in fact, the American-British armies, what they called liberating Italy in 1943-44, they were appalled to discover that northern Italy had been liberated by the resistance, which had established a functioning society with very strong labor control. The resistance was mostly labor and peasant-based. They'd held off the Germans, had liberated most of the place. They had instituted worker management in factories. They had thrown out what were called the Americans and British. They were protecting workers. What they call, I'm now speaking for the terminology of the U.S.-British documents. They were keeping useless workers and throwing out, arbitrarily dismissing owners and bosses. And that's, of course, intolerable. And the system was functioning. Furthermore, they were focusing on unemployment, which was recognized was Italy's major problem. But that's their problem, not our problem. Our problem is to restore the traditional structure, which meant traditional hierarchies. Actually, it meant restoring fascist structures and fascist collaborators and so on. And a big effort was made to do that. And it was not entirely successful. By 1948, when the first election took place, it looked as if labor-based forces would probably win. And a huge effort went into trying to ensure that that wouldn't happen by withholding food. Italy was starving, by restoring the police to fascist control, by all sorts of threats and manipulation. Pretty big operation, and the first major CIA operation, among others. And they took it really seriously. Again, something you would learn in a free society is there's a thing called the National Security Council, you know, which the main planning outfit, which publishes, I mean, doesn't publish, but it produces documents, top-level planning documents, which are among, not the only important ones, but among the most important ones. They tend to get released maybe 35 years later, so you can look back at them. So we have them now from the late 40s. And the first one, NSC 1, 1947, is devoted to Italy. And it calls for, it says, you know, we're going to try all these measures to ensure that Italy doesn't have a free democratic government, which would have, they don't say it this way, but what amounts to, that, which in which there'd be a big role for the organized working class in Italy. But, and they say, but if this doesn't work, you know, if the communists, as they call them, which means, in fact, a lot of them were communists, but if the communists come to power through a legal vote, through a legal election, then the United States is going to declare a national emergency and is going to support military activities inside Italy to overthrow the democratically elected government. That's how seriously they took it back in 1947. They also knew exactly why the communists were powerful. You read it in the records extensively. It's because they were honest, because they were supporting working class interests. It's true that they were collaborationists. They weren't trying to separate Italy from the Western Alliance or anything, but they were defending working class interests, and people supported them. And they had a mass-based working class party. There were plenty of others besides communists. But they had to be prevented either by coercion, like, say, withholding food and violence, or if that didn't work, by direct intervention, military intervention. That was taken very seriously, and in fact, it goes up to the present.
You know, how is it that the wealthy can, quote, pull the wool over the eyes of the American worker by controlling the power in government and using it against the working public, using it against mm-hmm. you know, labor unions?
Well, take right now, let's say, as an example. There's a couple days ago, I don't know if you bother, I put myself through the pain of reading the New York Times every day for some masochistic reason, which I won't try to explain. But they've got a, you know, their big chief correspondent, sort of the main thinker, is a guy named Thomas Friedman, who had an article 3 or 4 days ago in which he, big think piece, in which he said, well, he said the Cold War's over, so, you know, the breakdown isn't hawks and doves anymore. We have to have some new breakdown. And he said the new breakdown, he says there's two. One is between integrationists and, what's the other term, I forget, you know, anti-integrationists. That means people who are in favor of more globalization and what they call free trade, which isn't free trade, and, you know, all that kind of stuff, and people who want to slow it down or end it. That's one break. And the other is between people who are in favor of a safety net and those who think that everybody ought to, you know, be on your own and get what you can. Okay, so those are the two ways people break up. And that gives you four possible types of people, right? Two of them he sort of dismisses as lunatics. So there's the Zapatistas and Ross Perot. They fit into two of those boxes. The other two boxes are sort of sane people, Clinton and Gingrich. And I'll put aside Gingrich, Clinton, but Gingrich, and this gets right to your point, I think, Gingrich is put in the corner that says integrationist and devil take the hindmost, you know, everybody for themselves. Well, that's testable. You know, it's testable that that's Gingrich's position. For example, on the question of whether Gingrich is an integrationist, like in favor of free trade, we can ask how he reacted when the Reagan administration instituted the greatest wave of protectionism since the 1930s. That's just straight protectionism, alongside of a huge increase in public subsidies to private power, to industry, along with, say, the biggest nationalization in American history, the takeover of Continental Illinois Bank, and so on and so forth. That's all radically anti-integrationist. Okay, how did Gingrich react? We can ask that question. Answer is he thought it's great, you know. What about the safety net story? I mean, Gingrich is in favor of people sort of being out there on their own, you know, rugged entrepreneurs and so on. I mean, you can check that too. He represents a county district, Cobb County, Georgia, which happens to be the, and he happens to hold the national championship in bringing federal subsidies to his rich constituents, to be precise, among suburban counties in the United States. Cobb County ranks third in federal subsidies, ranks right after Arlington, Virginia, which is part of the federal government. So, of course, they get a lot of federal subsidies, like the Pentagon's there and so on. And Brevard County, Florida, which is the home of the Space Center. So it's another part of the federal government. But if you move outside the federal government itself, Gingrich's district is number one. You know, they get more federal subsidies than anybody. The biggest employer in Cobb County is Lockheed, which is a publicly subsidized private profit corporation. I mean, they don't, you know. I mean, they sell commercial planes, but those are just, as everyone knows, they're just, you know, kind of, they use military technology is, the way the system is designed, technology is developed under the guise of the military and then handed over to private power when it works. That's true of everything. Airplanes, computers, the internet, you name it. And Cobb County is right at the center of this. Well, he's in favor of being, you know, all out on your own and fighting in this harsh world. Ridiculous. He's the biggest welfare freak in the country. That's literally true. Except that he wants the welfare to go to very rich people. Notice this is not what's called corporate welfare. The corporate welfare, what they call corporate welfare, which also never gets touched, is some different category completely. That's like giving a special, you know, shot in the arm to some particular corporation. This is something quite different. This is the way in which our economy works. The way our economy works, take any just about any dynamic sector of it you know, at least that I know and I've studied, and you find that it's based on massive public subsidy and privatization of profit. Public pays the costs and takes the risks, and private systems make the profit, if there is any. Cobb County is just an extreme example of this. Now, you ask, how come people are deluded? Well, how often do you read this? You know, I mean, like, these aren't particularly subtle facts. I mean, these are, like, glaringly obvious facts.
Yeah, that's my question.
Okay, because the reason is because people like Thomas Friedman and everyone else in the business knows you're not supposed to write about these things. I mean, I don't know. I'm not claiming he thinks about it, you know. In fact, the people who write about it are probably more deeply propagandized even than the people they're talking to. You know, you cannot be a good propagandist unless it's in your bones. I mean, it's extremely hard to lie. I mean, I think we all know that from personal experience. You know, it's hard to lie to people. Every one of us lies to people all the time, unless we're some kind of crazy angels. But the way we do it, I'm sure you know this, is you first convince yourself that what you're saying is true. You know, like you're an 8-year-old kid and you steal a toy from your brother, you know, and your mother comes in and yells at you. You don't say, well, you know, I wanted the toy and he had it, so, you know, I took it because I'm stronger than him. What you say is, it really wasn't his, and besides, he'd taken a toy of mine, and anyway, I needed it more than he did, so it was right for me to take it, okay? You know, I mean, if people haven't had that experience, there are some other species, I think. But that kind of experience goes all the way up to being a hotshot journalist for the New York Times. You know, you don't even make it into those circles unless you're already so deeply overwhelmed by doctrine and propaganda that you can't even think in other terms. And so you'll read, say, you know, liberal columnists in the New York Times very angrily saying when people talk like this, nobody tells me what to write. I write anything I feel like, which is absolutely true. And if they didn't, if you know, people with real power weren't sure that they were going to say the right things, they wouldn't be in a position to write anything they feel like. Well, how does that work? You know, it starts from childhood. It starts in kindergarten on television. There's selection for obedience from the very first moment. I mean, you just think about, I mean, I'm guessing, maybe I'm wrong, so you tell me if I'm wrong, but at least when I think about my own school experience or any other school experience I know about, there was selection for obedience. I mean, I ended up going to fancy colleges like this place. And the way I did it was, I know exactly how I did it, by shutting up, you know. Like if I thought that the high school teacher was a horse's ass, which I did most of the time, I didn't say, hey, what you're saying, actually sometimes I did and got thrown out of class, but I learned not to say anything, just say, okay, you know, I'll do the next stupid assignment, and because I know that that's the way I get ahead, and ultimately I'll do this and that. You know, if you have, you know, whatever ability it takes to do this kind of thing, and you are sufficiently disciplined and passive, you sort of make it through up to the higher echelons. There are people who don't. I mean, I know some, like some of my own kids just didn't. And they get into trouble. They're called behavior problems or, you know, disruptive, or you stick drugs in them or something or other, because they're just too independent, you know. And people who are independent are a pain in the neck, you know, they disrupt the system. And they're going to be cut off one way or another. I can tell you, just, you know, in graduate school, I'm teaching mostly graduate school, and you read applications. You can detect between the lines when the person who's writing a recommendation is telling you, keep away from this person, they're going to cause you trouble, which means usually they're going to go off and do their own thing or something like that. I don't want to exaggerate. In the sciences, it's somewhat different. And the reason is the sciences simply require this kind of independence. They'll die, you know, unless people are challenging all the time and questioning. So when you look at people who are, say, studying physics at MIT or something, yeah, it's totally different. Because you just encourage people to be challenging and creative and so on and so forth. But in most areas, you don't. You want them to be passive and obedient and supportive and to fit their, you know, to fit some kind of niche inside a managerial system, which is top-down and doesn't make too much of a fuss and so on. And the people who don't accept this, they're weeded out in one or another fashion. It's a tricky question. I don't mean to suggest there's an easy answer to your question, or if there is, I don't know it. But it seems to me that an awful lot of our whole system of kind of thought control, by that I mean education, you know, television, family life, all sorts of things, is sort of geared to supporting that kind of passivity. And institutions that break out of it, as the labor movement does, they're subject to a lot of they're crushed insofar as one can crush them. I mean, the labor movement always broke out of this. Its picture was always different from the very beginning. You go back to the beginnings of the labor movement, it's, you know, farmers bitterly opposing the degrading and oppressive modes of industrial capitalist organization that were being forced on them. Actually, one of the most interesting books I know, if you haven't read it, I'd urge you to, is the first modern book on labor history that I know of, by a guy named Norman Ware. Around 1924, it was just reprinted, so it's easy to get, but it's about the labor movement in eastern Massachusetts around 1850 and 60. It's mostly quotes from the labor press, which are just fascinating. It's mostly young women from the farms, what they called factory girls, like 18-year-old kid comes in from the farms and she's working in the mills in Lowell, or artisans in Boston, you know, and people like that. They had their own press. They had a very lively, extensive press, big, in fact. You know, it's like the scale of the commercial press in those days. And it's very interesting. I mean, it's very eloquent, it's very well written. They took for granted, as the labor movement always has, unless it's beaten out of people's heads, that those who work in the mills ought to own them. They regarded industrial capitalism as just another form of slavery. This is without, you know, no Marx, no socialism, you know, no foreign radicals, none of that stuff. It's all just working people from their own experience. Very literate, incidentally. Like, one of the things they complained about was that their culture was being taken away from them. like an artisan in Boston, if he had a little extra money, would hire a boy to read to him, and that meant read classics, you know. They said, look, the values that we fought for in the American Revolution, they're being taken away from us. We're being forced into another kind of tyranny, which we don't want, namely the tyranny of the hierarchic industrial system. And they also opposed what they called the new spirit of the age. This is like 1850. The new spirit of the age is gain wealth, forgetting all but self. Okay, ever hear that one? A little fancier, but the same thing that is drilled into everyone's head every day, today. You know, you got to gain wealth, forgetting about everybody else. Well, they were trying to drill it into people's heads in 1850, and they were resisting it because it's degrading. You know, it's not the way human beings are. It takes a long time to drive normal human sentiments out of people's heads, and they keep popping up again. And in fact, I think, at least looks to me, the whole history of the labor movement is a struggle against the new spirit of the age. Well, that's one of the reasons it's constantly repressed. And other independent efforts are also constantly repressed, not always successfully. Like, the world's a lot better than it was 100 years ago, or 50 years ago, for that matter, because these struggles tend to, you know, they get repressed, but they leave a residue. They have successes, and then they're beaten back, and then they go on from those successes, and over time, it sort of gets better. Structures that are based on authority and dominance will try to will just normally act without anybody even thinking about it to block such tendencies. Now, sometimes they think about it, like in the manuals of the public relations industry. They think about it very hard, but you know, they're putting out billions of dollars a year to control the public mind. You better think about what you're doing. But most of the time, you don't think about it. You're just part of it. You know? Like, you don't think about the fact that when you go through school, you're being trained for obedience and passivity. But I think if you look back, you'll probably, at least if you're like my experience, will recognize that that happened. And when you watch television, let's say, you know, some sitcom, you don't think, well, I'm being exposed to the Mohawk Valley formula. But you are. I mean, that's the picture of life that's presented day after day after day. On, you know, like people have personal problems or something like that, but nothing that would bring them together to work for some, you know, to struggle against the new spirit of the age. I mean, what's the last time you saw a sitcom about that? And in fact, what you get is this, you know, this stuff that flows out of the PR industry, very consciously. You know, I mean, in that case, it's mostly conscious. Another aspect of it is demonizing labor. So a major element in the huge public relations propaganda after the Second World War, you know, was strictly demonizing labor. And the labor movement knew that. You know, there was a fairly substantial labor press even then, as late as the 1950s. There were still about 800 labor newspapers, which were reaching maybe 20 or 30 million people a week. You know, not commercial media, but pretty substantial. And they're interesting reading, too. They were trying to, as they put it, provide... This is just... I'm not talking about anything radical. You know, it's like no left-wing press or anything, just labor newspapers, you know, the conservative American labor movement. We're talking about developing antidotes to the poisons of the kept press, commercial media, who were demonizing labor at every opportunity and trying to undermine our achievements and glossing over the crimes of the corporate rulers who run the society, you know, stuff like that. There's a good book on this one, too, this just tells you something about American academic life. The first study that I've ever heard of, you know, in the United States on this major theme of modern history just appeared. University of Illinois Press, it's a book called Selling Free Enterprise by a woman named Elizabeth Fones Wolf, F-O-N-E-S-Wolf. It's kind of apolitical, but like she doesn't have any special point of view, but the material in it is pretty revealing. It's the next part of the story that I was going to get to. This hazard facing industrialists, you know, and the rising political power of the masses that led to the Mohawk Valley formula and so on, that terrified the daylights out of the business community. Now, it was kind of put on hold during the Second World War, but it took off immediately after the Second World War at a huge scale, instantly, you know. And that's what she's talking about, selling free enterprise. The idea was, as they put it, remember that the United States came out of the Second World War pretty social democratic, like most of the world. You know, like just like those Italian workers who had to have ideas about worker management beaten out of their head by force. An awful lot of people in the United States, too, like maybe half, thought that there ought to be popular control over industry in some fashion. You know, this is so exotic in the United States that the fashion was never described, but somehow that the government could do a better job than private power, things like that. There was enormous support for social programs, you know, medical programs and so on. That had to be beaten out of people's heads, and fast. The leaders of the public relations industry, she quotes a lot of them, they said, look, we have 3 to 5 years to save our way of life. We have to fight and quickly win what they called the everlasting battle for the minds of men and indoctrinate people with the capitalist story so fully that they can repeat it on every opportunity, and on like that. And they weren't kidding around. I mean, for example, about a third of the material in American schools, elementary schools, was coming straight out of corporate propaganda offices by the early 50s. Sports leagues were taken over. The churches were taken over. The universities were attacked. I mean, it was across the board, you know, major effort to try to win the everlasting battle for the minds of men. And it's still going on, you know. I mean, here it's conscious. No, that part of it's conscious. Most of it is, most of the participants, it's just, you know, it's in your bones. I mean, you've gone through the, especially if you've been through an elite educational system. And, you know, then it's, you're really deeply indoctrinated in it. So I don't know how to measure this, personal feeling is that you find more passivity and obedience in the elite centers than you do, like, you know, out in the street.